You're listening to an iHeart podcast.
The FBI now confirming that this man, Samuel Little, the most prolific U.S. serial killer in history. We have just gotten our mitts on spine-chilling confessions and jailhouse sketches that Little draws of his victim. Can you just imagine all these families, the children of these women, 93 that we know of, the husbands, the boyfriends, the moms and dads, oh dear Lord, they think that their daughter just left and never came back, just left them, abandoned them. They never knew what happened to mommy. They never knew what happened to their daughter, their girlfriend, their lover, their fiancé. Oh! Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
What do you think is the first time you had a killing?
1970.
Do you remember the first one?
2 years.
Yeah?
Pull hand around neck, and that was it. She evidently wanted this to happen, you know.
So how long after the first one before you did the second one?
About a month, too.
So you're going pretty quick.
Yeah, man.
How did you kill her? What happened? Same
procedure. I kissed her. Everything. I kissed her. You know, I see what you do if I sleep with you.
Ain't much I could do.
You better bless the heart.
Oh, dear Lord in heaven. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. Thank you for being with us, with me. Truly an all-star panel. Medical examiner for the state of Florida, Dr. Tim Gallagher. Forensics expert, founder of Bare Bones Consulting, Karen Smith. Former FBI special agent, host of Facebook Watch series Curse of Akakor, Bobby Chacone. And renowned psychoanalyst out of Hollywood, Bethany Marshall. You know, first, I got to go to Levi Page, crimeonline.com, investigative journalist, where you can read about this and all other breaking crime and justice news. You know what, Levi? As much as I want to hear from you, I got to hear it from the horse's mouth. We have tapes of serial killer Samuel Little. Listen.
I met her in a nightclub in New Orleans. We walked outside and she looked and seen my car at Lincoln. She said, ooh, you know, that's a beautiful car too. So she had arm in arm, walking to the car. We got in, stopped at the gas station. We was on the Highway 10 and going toward Slidell. And I seen the sign say Little Woods. Mm-hmm. So I cut off, I took off the exit, went, and that sure enough was the road leading into the woods. And we went in and parked. So we finally got to where we were going, and it was by a bayou, a river, a little water thing, and the big, they had a machine out there in that little river.
Dredging. Okay.
I grabbed her by the legs and pulled her to the water. Mm-hmm. That's the only one that I ever killed by drowning.
Describe the location where she's left.
Okay, I left her with her head still laying in the water, half her body in the underwater, and her thighs and legs on the bank.
Oh, dear Lord. I know I keep saying, oh, dear Lord, but just hearing him and hearing him laugh. Now, before I had John David and Lucy, the twins, I would go very often with one of my best friend girls, Renee, who sadly is a defense lawyer, but she and her whole very extensive Cajun family, we would go visit them, drive all the way from inner city Atlanta after court, right there to the Slidell area. I know, I think exactly what he's talking about. Levi Page, crimeonline.com investigative journalist. Did you hear him laughing?
Yes, and he's talking about them very casually. He's laughing. He has a smile on his face. You would think that he would be talking about a happy time in his life. And the psychologist and the experts can talk about maybe this was a happy time in his life. But it's extremely disturbing to listen to him confess to all of these murders. And we know that he's responsible, confirmed, for about 50 murders out of about 93 that he has confessed to, that making him the most prolific serial killer in the U.S., surpassing Gary Ridgway, who was convicted of 49 murders in the state of Washington.
Well, Levi Page, you're just a fountain of information, aren't you? I mean, I could have done without hearing about Ridgway on top of Samuel Little, but you just had to do it. Well, actually, Levi, you're right. Bethany Marshall, Jackie, if you don't mind, I want to go back and play that first sound we heard of Samuel Little. Listen as he describes to Texas Rangers how, quote, she wanted this to happen.
Do you remember the first one?
2 years.
Yeah.
Pull hand around neck, and that was it. She evidently wanted this to happen, you know.
So how long after the first one before you did the second one?
About a month, too.
So you're going pretty quick.
Yeah, man.
How did you kill her? What happened? Same
procedure. I kissed her. Everything. I kissed her. You know, I see what you do if I sleep with you.
How much I could do.
You better bless her heart.
To the second victim, he says, what would you do if I choked you? And he says she wanted this to happen. You know what? I usually hear that in rape cases, Bethany Marshall. I don't usually hear that in murder cases.
Well, one of the things we know about serial killers is that they have prolific fantasy lives. They infuse the memory of the crime as well as the crime itself with sexual excitement. That's one of the MOs of the crime, is to choke, look at the victim's face to increase their sexual arousal. So he's probably thought about these crimes so many times while he's in jail. He's relived, he's changed their narrative, he has all kinds of fantasies about what it meant to the woman. So giving the interview, not only is giving the interview a form of reliving the crime, because he's enjoying talking about this, but he's changed the narrative again and again to either minimize the severity of what he did or to infuse it with more excitement, because, you know, all he's doing is sitting in jail with his fantasies. That's all he has at this point.
To Dr. Tim Gallagher, the medical examiner for the state of Florida, Dr. Gallagher, did you hear what Bethany just said? I mean, just the thought of him getting enjoyment as he watches the victim strangle. What does a victim physically go through as they are strangled? I mean, I can only assume they know what's happening. It's not like you get a blow to the head or your throat is sliced or you take a bullet and you're gone. That's it. Immediate. Here, you know what's happening to you. You know you're dying.
Well, that's true, Nancy. You know, being manually strangled is a very protracted thing and could take as long as 3 minutes. While you're being strangled, you then become consciously aware that you are now fighting for your life. And then every ounce of strength you have, you're going to direct it toward the person who's attacking you. Until finally, you run out of strength, your body is deprived of oxygen, and then you cannot fight any longer. You become unconscious, and then after a while, you suffer irreparable brain damage, and that leads directly to your death afterwards.
As you are being deprived of oxygen, what would someone experience? I'll give you a sugar-coated version. Do you remember the Alfred Hitchcock movie where Grace Kelly, the husband, of course, is trying to kill her, blah, 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 and she is being strangled with a stocking? And she is, I want to say, dial in for murder. But anyway, long story short, you see her struggling and fighting to live, and slowly the energy is ebbing out of her. Having seen real strangulation victims, manual or ligature strangulation victims, it's not as airbrushed as that.
The small blood vessels in your eye do burst, and they form little hemorrhages that you can see on the white parts of your eye. But you know, before that, you know, we've found flesh under the fingernails of victims who were manually strangled, and it's It's often their own flesh trying to get the hands off of them. And it's quite often the flesh of the assailant. We can get DNA from that and then identify, you know, who was doing the strangulation. But typically, as your brain is deprived of oxygen, the first thing you develop is a very focused tunnel vision, and you are looking directly at your attacker. And as the peripheral vision starts to close off, you start to black out, and then you start to become unresponsive. And then after that, death is soon to follow.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Tell me about Mary Ann.
This opportunity popped up. Mm-hmm. Take her to the store.
Right.
She didn't even bring it up back to the mother apartment. I went down to 27th Street. That's going down to Fort Lauderdale, called Alligator Alley. It turns into, it runs into Alligator Alley.
Right.
But the further out you get, the further you get out of Miami.
Right.
And you got vegetation in there. Okay. And I seen a road going off the main road back into vegetation on the left side. So I got her out of the car, pulled her out, and drug her into the growth back there. And pulled her deeper into there's a path. A little path was running somewhere, I don't know where it led it to, but it was running deeper into the undergrowth. It's like Everglades like that. And we ran into some water running. But before we got to the water, the earth was mushy. I turned loose, and she fell into it face down.
And how far outside of Miami do you think you were?
About a mile, 2 miles.
What year did Mariana occur?
72.
Joining me, former special agent with the FBI, host of Facebook Watch series Curse of Akakor, Bobby Chacon. Bobby, what do you make of it?
Well, you can hear him. You can hear a little talk about the locations he was choosing, right? This road that ran off into the Everglades. He knew that these were places that he could that his predatory behavior would be successful because it was off the beaten track. There was maybe nobody around. And so you can hear his conscious thought as a predator. This is the mind of a predator. And this is the same thing that goes with any predator that's stalking its prey. It's judging the location. It's knowing when to strike. And those factors. And it's fascinating to hear this predator go through that mental exercise, because we know it happens, but to hear him verbalize it, that, you know, he's in his mind analyzing the scene as it's happening. He knows there's a potential victim there. He's seeing the road that leads off into a isolated place. And you can hear him talking very matter-of-factly, doing that analysis in his head that you know, we always talk about a predator going through. But it's chilling when you can hear him, you know, literally articulate the process that's going on in his brain when he sees a potential victim and he's analyzing whether he should strike.
We have obtained actual audio of the most prolific serial killer in the U.S. We believe at least 93 women killed by him, usually the same MO, the same modus operandi, method of operation. Are there more? Listen to him in his own chilling words.
How many states, different states, you think?
Florida, Georgia, come all the way up. East Coast, come down, Triple Mile, Indiana, come down, Illinois, Lake, all the way down the street, then go across, come back up. Until you get to California, Los Angeles.
How many in LA?
I'd say about 20. I know, I lost control. And I always was very cautious and tried to keep from getting busted. And I didn't pick on that it would be missed. There were no women nurses and civil teachers and all that kind of stuff. That's the reason why I didn't get busted a long time ago.
You like white girls or black girls better?
Black.
Yeah.
I mean, I ain't prejudiced, but I love black girls.
Did you hear that? He doesn't want to be prejudiced in which women he picks to kill. With me, Dr. Bethany Marshall, Bobby Chacon, Karen Smith, Dr. Tim Gallagher, and Levi Page. Karen Smith, forensics expert, founder of Bare Bones Consulting. So far, the FBI is saying that they have confirmed, their word not mine, confirmed 50 of his confessed 93 murders. How can they do that? Because some of these murders date years back.
They do. These date back to 1966, I believe, was one of the first ones when he was starting to offend and do armed robberies and things like that. So it's not that we have DNA. It's not that we have the direct evidence. But what's remarkable about Samuel Little, as vile as he is his memory. This man has detailed these murders, the location where he was, the timing. He described the clothing. He described things that he got busted for while he was there, shoplifting and other things that there are records of. So they can go back, maybe talk to surviving family members, describe these women, show them drawings that Samuel Little has done, and make identifications that way. So it's not that they have the direct DNA or a fingerprint or anything like that. What they have is the timeline, his descriptions, the information, and they went from there to say that, yeah, they're confident that these 50 belong to Samuel Little.
Right now, the FBI desperately asking for your help to identify so many of the 93 alleged victims of serial killer Samuel Little, including one woman he murdered in Laurel. Listen.
Samuel Little says he strangled 93 people in 19 states between 1970 and 2005. The 79-year-old is in California serving multiple life sentences and just recently began admitting to murders investigators believe are credible.
I can truly say that Samuel Little is a true monster. He's every woman's ultimate nightmare.
One of his alleged murders happened in Laurel in 1972. Little admitted to picking up the victim this summer at a Washington, D.C. bus station. Later drove her to a wooded area where Little said they had sex and he strangled her.
He described it when I interviewed him in a way where he was actually excited about describing how he did this murder.
A hunter found her body months later.
He described the victim, and the way that the medical examiner described her matched.
Investigators gave Little supplies to draw his victims when 60 Minutes got a look this weekend. There, in the bottom left, is a Jane Doe from Prince George's County. Officials say she was between 20 and 25 years old and possibly originally from Massachusetts. Little preyed on vulnerable women across the country, as he told CBS News by phone.
I don't think there was another person that did what I'd like to do. I think the only one in the world. And that's not an honor. That is a curse.
The FBI is now asking for help in matching confessions to victims, including that Jane Doe found in Laurel 47 years ago.
You're hearing our friends there at WJZ, the FBI, desperate to identify all of these women. Remember, their families still, many of them think mommy just abandoned them, when in reality, this devil from hell stalked and murdered them. To Dr. Bethany Marshall joining us out of LA, Dr. Bethany, did you hear what the FBI agent said? He said that Samuel Little gets excited in the retelling of the murders.
So sick, Nancy. In order to get off sexually, he would prey on vulnerable women. He would have sex with them. He would manually strangulate them, all for the purpose of sexual arousal. That is the MO right there. And again, because he's sitting in jail with nothing else to do but, you know, draw these pictures, which is probably like his jailhouse porn, he is excited in the retelling of the story because that is all he has.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. We are talking about Samuel Little, the most prolific U.S. serial killer in history. Take a listen as Samuel Little confesses to murdering, as he says, a, quote, girl in Northern Kentucky after a music festival.
We got to Covington, and then we continued through Covington. Mm-hmm. And there was a park that they were having a festival there. And she heard the music and she loved that band in there. And by her being a heavy type, you know, she wanted to get to that. But the police came over and peeped in her car. He really wanted me to move out of there. So we, instead of going in there, I took her the other way.
Right.
Winding round, they got hills down in Kentucky, and the road winds around the hills. Mm-hmm. I seen a little short road going up the hill, and up top there was vegetation, wasn't no houses or nothing. And so I pulled up in there and concealed my, the car in that little vegetation up there on top of the hill.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about this road that goes up the hill. What kind of road is it?
It was like a dirt road.
Okay.
It was like dirt. The grass was growing in the middle between two tracks. When I left her up in that little road up there, on the side of that little road, she was like partially concealed by the vegetation. And I left her there.
You are hearing the description of a murder of a, quote, girl in northern Kentucky that was listening to music at a music festival in a park. I don't get it. To Bobby Chacon, former special agent with the FBI, host of Facebook Watch series Curse of Akakor. Bobby, why such detail? Is he proud?
Well, you know what? He doesn't. He lacks the empathy that we would normally say, oh, my God, how can he do that, right? Because you to recall and such. Yes, in a way, he is proud. But in a way, this is just another regular memory for him that you and I would recall a birthday party or an anniversary in the past. So it's not, you know, he does have a remarkable memory, and he does get some satisfaction, although at his age it's less than it was when he was younger, in recalling some of these crimes. But in this case, the Texas Ranger he's talking to, Holland, developed such an incredible rapport with him that he's actually wanting to help the detective bring closure to some of the families. And that's what he's been doing. He's been completely cooperating with the interviews since Ranger Holland established that relationship. And you hear him again talk about, you know, this is a situation he just explained where the police came up to his car and shooed him away. He was parked somewhere with his next victim that he wasn't supposed to be. And so they shooed him away and he just drove on. Now, instead of letting her out of the car in a panic because the police just were there, he actually drove and he immediately started looking for hills and vegetation that could, as he said, conceal his car. This is a predatory machine. He's going through the analysis right after leaving the police with the victim in his car of looking for a place where he can carry out his crime. So it's really a fascinating look into the mind of a predator where he's just, the police didn't even faze him. The police coming up to his car with the victim in his car didn't even faze him. And he immediately started to analyze his surroundings on where he could carry out his attack.
Bobby Chacon with me, former FBI, to Dr. Tim Gallagher, medical examiner for the state of Florida. Dr. Gallagher, I was earlier asking Karen Smith with Bare Bones Consulting about how the FBI has been able to confirm at least 50 of these alleged 93 murders. Dr. Gallagher, what type of bodily evidence would there be? This much later, I mean, years have passed. Can you go back to a body, even if after it's been buried, or can you observe tissue at the time? How can they connect him to many of these women?
Well, there are several ways we can do it. Number one would be dental records. If they had any dental records that are still available, we could use those for identification. You know, and the other thing is familial DNA. You know, if there are any members of the family that are left, DNA can still be extracted from the bones of the victim or from the teeth of the victim, and that DNA could be analyzed familial and ignorant or of the victim, which would give us a good presumptive identification.
I know we can ID the victim, and I'm trying to figure out how to connect him to a murder. I guess one way, Karen Smith, Bare Bones Consulting, would be, as Dr. Gallagher is saying, to put his, Samuel Little's, DNA into the DNA databank, CODIS, and see how many women he connects to over the years, because obviously he raped, sodomized, or performed some other sex act on probably all of the women during the strangulation, before, during, or after. But what other evidence could we look for beside DNA, Karen Smith?
Right. There is a part of CODIS, which is the Combined DNA Index System. One of those parts is the forensic database. That connects two or more crimes that are
that are connected, and then they can go into the offender database and make a match that way, which is what they've been doing. But here's the thing. If it's been 30, 40 years, Nancy, if you find any skeletal remains, you know, you're going to be dealing with dental records. You're going to be dealing with DNA from bones and things like that. But the one thing that you may be able to find, if they're very lucky, are pieces of cloth and clothing that have not been dragged off, that have not decomposed to the point of being unable to identify that piece of clothing, even if it's a scrap. He described one victim as wearing a cream and red colored skirt. And if there's a small shard of that left, that may be able to also help identify the victim. So you're dealing with jewelry. That doesn't go away. Things like that, earrings, necklaces, rings, that may be able to be found at the location if they're able to locate these bodies.
How did Texas Ranger James Holland get this serial killer to confess?
The ranger says Little was a cunning killer who sized up his victims and his surroundings.
The first thing I picked up on is how wicked smart he was. This guy
smart.
Is, oh, like genius.
Why?
Yes, absolutely.
Why do you say that?
Oh, well, number one, you know, the photographic memory, his memory for details. You're like, Sammy, tell me what's around her. There's three tombstones over there. There's a Caliche Road, drive down a quarter mile. There's a white Baptist church that needs to be whitewashed. Phenomenal.
So how do you reach a serial killer? How do you get them to talk?
You avoid the things that normally work for investigators.
What do you mean by that?
You avoid things like, you know, remorse and closure for the family.
Because they don't have remorse and they don't care about closure.
No, it doesn't appeal to them at all. I mean, you're asking them to open up their soul to the things that are more intimate to them than anything in life. Why should they do that with you? And that's what you're working for.
The skinny black girl, real friendly. She was laughing while I was killing her.
With Sammy, there's indications of visualization of when he's thinking about a crime scene, he'll start stroking his face. And as he's starting to picture a victim, you'll see him look out and up. And you can tell he has this revolving carousel of victims, and it's just spinning, and he's waiting for it to stop at the one that he wants to talk about.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. We are talking about Samuel Little, the most prolific U.S. serial killer in history. Take a listen to what Samuel Little says about Little Rock, Arkansas.
Oh, man, I love this. I forget her name. Oh, wait. I think it was Ruth.
Okay.
She was a heavy set, big old yellow gal, and had buck teeth. She had a gap between the teeth, that's what it was. And she was like honey colored skin. And she had, her hair was not really long. It was,
how tall do you think she was?
She was about 5'7".
How much do you think she weighed?
She weighed about close to 200, about 170.
Pretty big girl.
Yeah.
Right. Now, where did you meet her at?
Okay, down in the crack house. Her and about six other girls was sitting on the porch. Do some crack in there. I stopped to go in there. I seen the girl, that's why I stopped. We stayed together 2 days or more. I think about 3 days. We was going shoplifting. We went to Sears. We went to Culver's, and that's where I got busted. Mm-hmm. They took me to jail, and she went and stayed in the car. And the manager of Culver's, I guess he got tired of her laying on his property in that car. He called the station where I was at in North Arkansas to drop the charges. Mm-hmm. So he can come down and get this gal and car out of here. They cut me loose. So we was headed toward with that place where Walmart's original store, Bentley. I whipped off the road and back into that little woods. It was a cornfield back there. I pulled through it, and on the other side of the cornfield was a trash pile. I parked the car facing out where I could see anybody coming in. So I pulled her out of the car. She's too big for me to carry her. So I just pulled out of the car and laid on that trash that was lit there.
So was it like a corn stalk pile, or was it?
Yeah, a bunch of corn stalks.
What could you see from there?
I could see the highway. And in the woods is that way. But it's right outside of Little Rock. I was about 10 miles from it.
From North Little Rock, you think 10 miles?
Yeah, it was about 10 miles.
Okay.
How brazen. To Bethany Marshall, psychoanalyst joining me from L.A., he could see the highway from where he was. He basically left her dead body near a highway, true, behind some corn stalks, but by the highway. Did you hear when he said, quote, I loved her, but he killed her?
And that she had buck teeth with a little gap, and that she had honey-colored skin. Nancy, you can hear the whole offending pattern in how he tells the story. He starts with her appearance, which is obviously what the Texas Ranger asked him about. He wanted a description. But, you know, you have that the honey-colored skin, the medium hair, the buck teeth, the little gap. So this is what he's doing. He's trolling for victims, and he's looking at their appearance. He probably has a type that he likes. Next, he commits some kind of a other petty crime. For what purpose? I don't know, at a Kroger's, at a grocery store. Then he starts looking for a place to secrete the body. And there are so many mentions of underbrush, or it's like a muddy swamp, or the vegetation in the area is very important to him. Going out onto a lonely road and then facing back towards the highway, it would be interesting to know, like, why he chose to do that. Was there something sort of almost exhibitionistic about that, as if he's, you know, killing this woman while at the same time looking down on society? You know, I think there's something there. I'm not sure that the Texas Ranger would be interested in that aspect of it, but I think it's really fascinating, and I think it could contribute to our common knowledge of serial killers, why they pick certain locations and why they offend in the particular ways that they do.
To Dr. Tim Gallagher, medical examiner for the state of Florida, when a body is left out in the elements, does it decompose much more quickly than if it was inside of a structure?
Oh, absolutely. And the reason why that is because the big variation in temperature. You know, decomposition is highly variable on the temperature and the external environment. In the outside, the sun is beating down on the body. There are predatory animals. There are scavenger insects that help in the acceleration of decomposition. We often find many pounds of maggots and beetles and worms inside of these bodies when they decompose, and that accelerates the decomposition.
You know, after watching and listening to hours of this guy confessing to one murder after the next, it's like he's describing going on dates with these women. He knows one is named Ruth. He says he loved her. He seems attached to her buck teeth and the little gap between the front two teeth. Bobby Chacone, host of Facebook Watch series Curse of Akakor, I notice he gets more and more animated and into it and excited as he describes how he strangles his victims. At one point, he says, she was fighting for her life, and I'm fighting for my pleasure.
Yeah, and this is a hallmark of a sexual sadist, which he probably was. And this is what Dr. Marshall described earlier, where he's deriving sexual pleasure out of her fear, anxiety, and pain. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, and we'll never know, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of these manual strangulations didn't end in death the first time. In other words, he brings them to the edge of death, and then they start. He allows them to start breathing again, and then he repeats the act. So, the sexual gratification that a sexual sadist will achieve is not from the sex act itself, but it's actually the lead up. And of course, now that he's able to talk about it again, he's reliving that, and he's deriving pleasure from it again. So that's what you're hearing in his voice. You're hearing that satisfaction and that pleasure that he's getting, recalling these many horrific crimes, you know, decades later.
Take a listen to what this prolific serial killer, Samuel Little, says about Vegas.
She was kind of thin, dark skin, about 40 years old when she was out there hustling. I think she was a drug addict because she wouldn't have been out there.
How tall was she?
She was about 5'5", 5'3".
And how much do you think she weighed?
She weighed about 110, 120.
Okay. What about her did you know?
The boy came, she left with her son. And she called him over there. And he came over, he shook my hand and everything,
Now how old was he?
He was about 20 or about 19, 20.
Okay, black male or?
Black male.
And where were you at when you met her?
It was on Owens Avenue.
Okay.
In Jackson.
Where do you eventually take her body to?
I was headed toward California.
Mm-hmm.
So as I drove out of Las Vegas, I seen a motel and a road leading up to the motel. And I said, there's a lot of bushes and brushes us beside the road before you got to that motel. That's where I pulled up her body out and rolled it down there. And I heard a secondary roll of noise. That meant she was still rolling.
To Dr. Bethany Marshall, Bobby Chacone, Karen Smith, Dr. Tim Gallagher, and Levi Page, the FBI still begging the public to help identify these victims and bring some peace to their long abandoned families. Can you even imagine that kind of pain? Go to crimeonline.com where you can see not only see and hear Samuel Little's confessions, analyze and judge him for yourself, but also links to help identify these women. We now know at least 93 women terrorized, sexually assaulted, and murdered. We wait as justice unfolds. Nancy Grace, Crime Story, signing off. Goodbye, friend.
You're listening to an iHeart podcast.